Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and you're listening to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC's proactive, personalized approach to engagement helps you build your major gift pipeline even in a time of social distancing. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights about alumni interest and connections and automatically delivers them to advancement professionals for use in cultivation. QBAC is a force multiplier for development officers, enabling them to focus on what they do best, developing deep relationships with individuals and converting them into active donors. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive Fundraising's training. If you are looking to align your team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about our four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, hire another member of your team, let's ensure everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you'd prefer a virtual seminar, we can do that too. Let's get your team thinking more critically and carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I'll also put some information in the show notes. Hi, Kevin. I am delighted to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast here today. I was reading through your notes, and I'm eager to have this conversation because it's a little, probably going to ruffle a couple of feathers, and we're going to say probably some bold things. But before we do that, how about we just ask you to introduce yourself?
Yeah. So my name is Kevin Fitzpatrick. I am the Director of Development for an organization called Heroic Media, based in Texas. I am also a major gift fundraising coach. I help my clients increase the quantity and quality of their visits so they can raise more meaningful gifts quickly. I grew up in New Orleans and moved to Texas to go to the University of Dallas in 2011 and have stuck around since then. I got introduced to the nonprofit world and the idea of fundraising as a career during my junior year and have never looked back. It's amazing.
So before we tackle the fundraising subject, Kevin, you indicated in your notes that during the year after Hurricane Katrina, you moved your family 17 times in 13 months. Now, I'm a military kid, and we moved every couple of years, but we've never. You've got to unpack that story. We all certainly understand the tragedy of Hurricane Katrina, but let's let our listeners get to know Kevin and perhaps your family a little better by telling us a little bit about that story.
Yeah. So back in the day, Katrina was a little over 15 years ago now. So I was just a young boy. I was about 11 or 12 years old. And I was going wherever my parents took us. And we'd evacuated many times growing up in New Orleans. And this time was different. We left the city with my mom's Suburban and my dad's F-150 and my brother and our border collie Bandit, and packed everything we could. And I knew this one was different when we were staying at our first location, a little motel kind of in northern Mississippi. And my uncle, my dad's brother, he had one job basically since he was 8 years old, working at the Southern Yacht Club in New Orleans. He started cleaning toilets and then eventually became the manager there. And the first thing we saw, the power was out at where we were staying. and someone had a TV plugged into the back of their pickup truck, and we were getting the news, and the first thing we saw when we knew it was real was helicopter footage of the Southern Yacht Club on fire. And after that, we moved around several times. Once satellite images were available, we could see our house was severely flooded. And yeah, we had a one-story house with 5 feet of water inside the house for about 3 weeks, and just completely devastated everything. And so we moved, yes, 17 times from the time we left to the time me, my dad, and my brother moved back in 1 year and 1 month after the storm hit. We moved back in. The reason we were able to move back in is we had one electrical outlet placed outside the house. And so we decided to move in, and we're able to do more work on the house then. So yeah, it was a wild ride, and very thankful for my parents navigating a very stressful time for a lot of reasons, especially financially, and turning it into a positive experience for me, and just focusing on, you know, time we could spend together in a unique way.
Yeah, so you were, I missed that detail as I was reading that. So you were 11 years old. So this had to, this experience had to have been formative at a very formative time in your life. And I have to, I mean, we're a podcast that talks about fundraising. Has that experience in some way sort of informed your professional choices and sort of maybe your, I don't know, I have to imagine it has.
Yes. Yeah, big time. I think about it all the time. I think about not worrying so much, not getting too attached to material possessions, because they can all go in a blink of an eye.
Yes, and they can.
And seeing generosity in others. I remember so many people just literally opening up their homes to us and letting us stay either in their primary residence or, you know, some sort of vacation home for months at a time at no cost to my parents. Stuff like that was just, I don't know every implication that it's had, but it's one of the most profound events of my life for sure.
Could you go back to all the, do you know where all those 17 places are? Like, could you retrace that journey?
I bet my mom could, combined with my brother. They've got incredible memories. Some of them were apartments, some were hotels, some were motels, some were just a couple nights at a time. But Dallas was on the list. Houston was on the list. When we got to Houston, there was a hurricane headed to Houston. So we wound up actually heading back to the New Orleans area to avoid that storm. And it was crazy.
Well, I appreciate you letting me ask you to unpack that, because I like to know that, I like to remind ourselves as fundraising professionals, I like us to remind ourselves that we're very human beings and we have meaningful experiences and that sort of stuff. So what are we going to talk about today? So I always give you the pleasure of sort of teeing up the conversation with a big idea or bold opinion. So what are we going to talk about today?
Yeah, so I think my wife could tell you I have no shortage of bold opinions. But today's topic, and kind of what I focus on in my career, is that major gift fundraising professionals as a whole suck at scheduling visits. Okay. I think it's the I'll just leave that there for a second and you can respond.
I don't know. Okay. I don't know if they suck at doing the work. I don't know that we prop them up or train them up to do it well. Is that fair?
Yes, that's exactly it.
Because I think the profession is too young at this point for us to point fingers at the fundraisers. I'm in consulting and training and that sort of stuff. I think I've got a whole league of my older peers in this consulting advisory training space that are largely the drivers behind that inability that you're suggesting they have. I don't think the 2 year in, 3 year in, 5 years in, even the 10 year in fundraising professional needs to think that they suck at this. I think we need to be completely aware of the fact that perhaps your track, and I'm not trying to hijack the conversation, but their path into the profession was poorly designed, poorly routed, and And that's why they end up in that place. So
yeah. So I do not want to assign blame to anyone. I put myself in the same category. Learning how to not suck at scheduling visits has been a journey I've been on my entire career. And really, when I say that is, I'll just give you an example. When I started, like you said, we're a young profession. I don't think there's enough. I think a lot of people get thrown into roles and they're not given the tools that they need to succeed. They don't have examples of what does success in major gift fundraising look like within their organization. And so they don't really have any reason to be particularly good at it. So when I first started at my organization, I didn't have any guidance above me, and it was just kind of go raise money. And so when I would call somebody, I seriously had no idea how to schedule a visit with someone. So a lot of times it would look something like this. I'd pick up the phone and I would not be direct or really tell the person why I was calling. I would say something like, "Hey, Bob, Kevin here with Heroic Media.
Right.
How you doing?" And then hopefully I would maybe somehow I would get to saying something like, "Oh, you live in that part of town? Oh, I live over there too. Maybe we should get together sometime if it ever works out." And they'd say something like, yeah, that sounds great, Kevin. Just let me know sometime. And then nothing would ever happen. And I think that not knowing exactly what to say, it was a huge roadblock in my career early on. And I think a lot of people are in that position because we just don't have people, especially at small organizations, above us who have successfully scheduled many visits with people of significant capacity. And so we just don't know how to do it.
Yeah. So what, okay. So you do coaching. I do coaching with development officers too. And, are we timing I guess one of the questions I would ask is, are we not strategic enough about the timing of when we ask for that first meeting?
I think that's potentially part of it. I think the main problem is that we just don't ask for that first meeting enough in the first place. Forget about
when do you want? So, you know, relatively new development officer, 2 years into his or her career, when do you think is the ideal time with an existing relationship? For example, a donor's been giving to the organization for, say, 2 years, same 2 years that the person's been in the job. When do you want them to ask for that meeting?
As soon as possible. If I'm a development officer at an organization and I come across, well, I'll just give you an example at my own organization. There are many people in our database who have significant financial capacity, and I have never visited with them. And so occasionally, you know, I'll have a list of people I've never visited with, but have been giving to our organization for a few years, maybe 1 year, 2 years. As soon as they come on my radar, I just give them a call and just start right there. I don't think there's any reason to mess around if we think that they have significant capacity and care about our mission.
With the KPI card that we use here at Responsive, we have a practice that sort of says that at the end of what some of the listeners are familiar with what we call the three lanes, and so at the end of lane one is essentially the thank you. This is a thank you, and so if lane one is doing what it's doing, I think too many organizations are focused on new donor acquisition in order to actually make money, and instead of it being about making money, they need to be focusing on establishing meaningful relationships. And so once that new donor comes through, and I think this is what you mean with greater specificity, if that's the right word to get that word out of there. I think what you're saying is that I want that donation to come through the door, and I want that development officer to not be so exhausted with whatever he or she did the day before, whether it's the getting the direct mail campaign out or whether it's the special event that they orchestrated or whatever, that they can pick up the phone and say, thank you. Because my answer to that question is that the best time to my own question is the best time to ask for a meeting is on the thank you call, when both the development officer person in yours and my seat and the donors, their guard is down the lowest. Because shoot, I mean, if you just gave me a gift yesterday, if you just gave us a $500 check at the gala yesterday, that's the best time to ask for a meeting. And it's the best time to demonstrate to the donor that something matters to you in addition to the fact that they gave a gift. Because you're basically saying, look, you gave us a gift yesterday. We want to have a relationship with you as well. And we're certainly not going to ask you for a check. You just gave us one.
Right. Yeah. And so that's exactly it. I think exactly what you talk about and what I love about what you talk about is this arm's length fundraising culture. I think so many organizations just, it's not a question of, did we reach out to the benefactor at the right time? It's just, we never reached out to him at all. And so getting that visit and beginning that relationship is key, because people give, you know, most of the time they give their largest gifts to the organizations that they have personal relationships with. And so if you're not spending time in front of your benefactors, there's another organization that is, and that's where they're giving the majority of their money.
Okay, so I want to take a break, but when we come back, what I'm really interested in is sort of what happens on the other side, because if you're saying that we're not very good at this, being good at this can't just be limited to getting the meeting. So right. We'll get you right back here in just a minute. All right, Kevin, so I am really enjoying this conversation. So we've been talking about the idea that maybe some of us are not very good at this major gift work that we've been assigned or tasked to do. And we were picking on sort of maybe the process by which we train people up and ask for the meeting. But there's got to be something else that we're not good at. And I'm guessing that you've got some thoughts about, so we get to the lunch table, we get to the Zoom meeting in the COVID reality.
Yeah.
What are we not, in your mind, what are we not just prepared enough for? I think that's, and let me preface the question with, I think in this current COVID reality where we're at, the skill to not only get that meeting and to be able to have a meaningful conversation in the Zoom space, for example, is going to be one of the most needed, necessary, and most valuable skills that you could have in this space, in this fundraising space. And quite frankly, I don't think enough of us have it. And I think more and more employers, especially if they're listening to my podcast, are going to hear this stuff and say, yeah, that's the skill I want this person to most demonstrate. And if you don't know how to do it, you may not be getting the job.
Yeah. So I'd say primarily the underlying philosophy is we have to be focused on putting the benefactor first. And so that changes everything. So that changes what we're willing to do to schedule the visit, and that changes what we're willing to do once we're on the visit. So if it's about you and the organization, that's when you get into the word vomit that many of us can be guilty of. And when it's about them, then we go into, you know, how do I serve this benefactor well? And if that's what we want to know, we're going to focus on learning more about them, asking good questions, and the more, you know, tactical skill that you might have been trying to draw out is listening. If we can't listen well in a real way, where we want to understand our benefactors, understand why they give significant gifts, understanding what they're passionate about, then we're never going to be able to present them with a truly meaningful opportunity of an amount and a timing that is meaningful to them.
Now this is a curveball for you. I always warn my guest after the break that sometimes I throw, but you sound like you know your stuff enough, and you sound like you've been around enough to have this conversation. So I think some of the predicament that we're talking about, you and I are talking about, is that some of us have spent our entire careers entrenched in this arm's length fundraising that I call it in the book, essentially doing work that sort of gets our professional identities wrapped up in this arm's length stuff. And then consequently, when we actually have to sit down across the lunch table and have a meaningful conversation with someone, we've been telling ourselves that we have relationships with these people when in fact we really don't. We don't have relationships with people. Relationships work two ways. And so if you think you're building relationships with people via direct mail, you're crazy. Yeah. Is some of this just the fact that maybe when we're talking about wanting to be really talented fundraisers, we need to be insisting on the real donor-facing roles earlier in the process? Because I think we can take two-year veterans and put them in front of donors and they'll be rock stars, you know, relatively quickly. But it's because they're developing those skills that I think people 10 years in don't have.
Yeah. And I'd say that's one of the biggest benefits I had in my career is I just got thrown into a system where I didn't have any of that. Well, we're going to start you off in this kind of more entry level thing of, you know, doing behind the computer stuff. Maybe it was just like, go start meeting with people. And so right. I was, you know,
that's my journey too, man. Yeah. I didn't have to earn my stripes in some of that shallow work. Right.
Yeah. And so you just get out there. And I mean, I tell you, one of the first people I met with that had a significant impact on my career, I'm not going to go too much into detail here, but I had no idea what I was doing. This guy took a visit with me. We developed this incredible relationship. And when I say relationship, what you were talking about, like this guy, he and I have been close to the point that when he was at one of the lowest points in his life, he's telling me about his near encounter with suicide. And he wanted me to, when he came out of that, he was trying to get better in a particular area of his life. And he said, Kevin, I want you to text me just every day, just ask me about this one thing. And I wasn't doing that because he was going to give us money. I was doing that because I love this guy and he's my friend. And he would do the same for me. And not every relationship is that personal in this field, but we need more relationships in front of people that, like you said, I mean, we get in these situations, and that's when you can ask somebody for $100,000 gift or $1 million gift, and it generally doesn't happen because we sent an email campaign or signed our name on a letter.
Yeah. So I told you before we hit the record button. So we do this training, Kevin, and this four-part training thing that we do for organizations. And so we had 12 people in the room. We started this yesterday. And the first exercise that Teresa asked them to do is what we call tell their money story. Yeah. And the money story asks three questions. The first question is, one of them is what were your parents' money habits? What's the first money memory that you remember from children, you know, as a child? And what do you, and how do you feel about money today? And what you basically realize, and then you get everybody around the room to tell this story.
Yeah.
And we had 12 people in this training yesterday, and they were telling their money stories. And what you start to realize, and I'm going to tie this back to what we're talking about really quickly here. What you start to realize is that the trick to really good fundraising is being able to see the money, but also knowing how to sort of see through it, get on the other side of it. And I think that's because I've had that same experience so many different times with people that I was engaging with in meaningful ways. But when you can see around or through their money, then you're not, then like the money's not the only thing we see, right?
Right.
You're able to build those meaningful relationships. But what you're also, and this is what this money story exercise allows us to do, is it allows us to see that human beings express their values and their wants and their desires for the world through their money. It's a way to express their values. It's what matters to them. And so when you allow people to do that, there's an intimacy. It's kind of like the training that I got early in my career. It's the idea that if a person will show you their checkbook, they'll show you what their values are.
Right.
You know, we hear a lot about that in the faith-based space, is the idea that, you know, where your money is, there's your heart too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been there, man. I have been in that seat where that donor just totally opens up. But I think it's because we see beyond the money. I think it's we see on the other side of the money.
Right. That's exactly it. And it's funny. And this is something we need to work towards, is letting our benefactors know that we really care about them. Because I've been in situations where benefactors have told me things in kind of a joking way, like, you know, like, oh, well, you just want to see me because of my money. And I sometimes have to convince people, like, look, forget about it. I'm not going to ask you for a gift. I'm coming to see you because I care about you. And I promise you, I will not ask you for a gift, because it's so much more important for us to have that trust and have that relationship. Because, again, if the underlying philosophy is we're there to serve the benefactor, and what you were talking about, looking through the money, it's at that time that when we're able to look through the money and see the benefactor and what they desire, then we can ask them for a significant gift in a way that they know, well, Jason did this because he knows that this is something that's deeply meaningful to me. And regardless of what I do, we're still going to stay in relationship.
So, now, use the word benefactor, and what a lot of people are talking about in our space. I don't know if you're on the Rogeri site. If you're not, I'll get you on the Rogeri site. But a lot of things that, like, Ian's talking about, he's a think tank guy in the United Kingdom that's been talking about this stuff. But it's the idea that some of this donor centrism stuff that we talk about, sort of focused on the benefactor, if you will, overlooks the beneficiary. And I think some of that accusation, and I think where something like donor-centered fundraising and all these other sort of cliches get themselves in trouble is because they're done at such an arm's length, because we're not at the lunch table, we never realize that these people don't want to be at the center of anything. They don't want it to be all about them. They want it to be about the beneficiary. They relate to the beneficiary. There's something in their story. There's something going on there. Maybe they can't identify with them, but they've got empathy for these people or something, whatever it is they're choosing to do. But I think all of the dysfunction, like you started with the idea that fundraising professionals don't know what the hell they're doing. Well, in reality, it seems like all of our problems that get conjured up when it comes to fundraising is this arm's length fundraising thing, that we're constantly sort of distancing ourselves from the donor. Consequently, we're drawing weird and strange assumptions about each other, never understanding that the beneficiary, the child we're trying to serve, or the homeless person, or the person on the other side of the world that's in very unfortunate circumstances, whatever. There's no conversation. We've never been in the room together. We've never had a meaningful conversation, but we're going to feel like we know each other in a meaningful way after 30 minutes,
right?
Just because we've done this, and we're not affording ourselves, those of us on the receiving side, we're not affording ourselves that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll give you, everything you said is true. And I think the idea of, you know, we need to be focused on the benefactor, I haven't thought about this too much, but the beneficiary is hugely part of it too. So I'll give you an example, and I'll tell you a little story. And my podcast, One Visit Away, that I'll give a little plug for, is having development officers tell stories like this, so that we can all learn from what does success really look like, not just theory, but like real stories. And so I'll tighten this one down really short. But there's a benefactor who, he'd given a lot of money to our organization, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and something had happened, I won't go into it too much now, that kind of screwed up the relationship. And I had to pick up the pieces when I came in. And so I called this guy, and for months I couldn't get him on the phone. And I finally get him on the phone, and I ask him for the visit, because, again, this isn't going to be repaired from some letter. I've got to get face to face with this
guy. Yeah, of course you do.
And so I go for the visit, and he tells me, look, Kevin, there's just really no reason for us to visit. And most people, I think this is what I get back to, we suck at scheduling visits. I think most people, when they get that first rejection, we just move on. The sales world would never let somebody get away with that. And so I kind of push back on this guy, and I basically ask him why. And then he goes in to tell me how we had kind of hurt the relationship. And so I apologized for me personally. I apologized from our organization. And then I asked him again for the visit and he said no. And then, but he told me, he said, Kevin, I'm still pro-life. I've just started giving to other organizations, not you guys. And so I said, yeah. Look, I was like, if I don't do this now, I'm going to lose this guy forever. And the whole time I'm thinking, I'm here to serve him. It's not about me. And so I said, look, you just told me that you're pro-life. And if that's true, what we're doing today is a different organization than when you were involved years ago. And we are, I believe, the most effective pro-life organization in the country. Me and my wife, we're young, but we're giving X amount to them, I told him, because we believe it's the most effective pro-life organization in the country. The reason I'm asking you for a visit is not because we need the money, but because if this really matters to you, I think you're going to want to know what we're doing today. And he said, all right, Kevin. And so we scheduled the visit and he got back on board and is giving at the same level to this day. And so I share that because it's that combination of I'm there to serve him and I want him to know that, but I'm also using why he cares about this as a motivation to take that next step. And now he and I have an incredible relationship. He's closer to the organization than ever before, but it only came because I avoided that arm's length and put myself in a potentially very uncomfortable position, which a lot of times we want to avoid.
Okay, so some people would say that because you and I are men, and because of privilege and any number of things, that boldness that you demonstrated there is sort of wrapped up in who we are. And so how do we teach that boldness to someone who doesn't have sort of the posture that you and I might have benefited from sort of coming up in the world? Because that's a lot of my guests, you know, I talk about that same confidence and that boldness and stuff. And they're going to remind me, they're going to say, Jason, you're a white straight male who sort of has enjoyed privilege just like every other white straight male for the last 400 years or something in this world. And so how do you teach that? How do you encourage that boldness for somebody who just doesn't sort of fit my profile, for example?
Yeah. So a couple things I'll say. One, completely agree that there's, you know, so many advantages that I have, like you, privilege. But I would say I, for a long time, did not have that level of confidence. And part of the reason that I'm able to have that confidence in this particular area is because I care so deeply about our mission and those that we serve. And I think, and a lot of times our adversities are being struggling against those helps us with confidence. And so I would say for someone who is not a straight white male, use the challenges that you've overcome and knowing how far you've come and what you've been able to accomplish, to focus on that and knowing that you are highly capable and that you're not doing it for yourself. You're doing it for that person who wants to make a difference, and you're doing it for that child who's starving. You're doing it for that organization that desperately needs help without you, and you are the person that is able to make that connection.
So, Kevin, one final thought. You know, I'm wondering, does everybody want, so sometimes, because anybody who listens to the podcast hears me say lunch table, lunch table, lunch table. But yeah. Some of my guests recently, and I'm sort of just sort of, I'm being vulnerable here. I'm going to see what your thoughts are here. What about those people who don't want the lunch table? Because I'm sort of picking up on that when I'm talking about the lunch table sometimes, I use that sort of term, you know, in quotes. It's not always the lunch table per se. But some people just don't want to be there at the lunch table. And so they don't want that meaningful interaction. And I don't know. I don't know necessarily whether or not I should press the development officer to push for that, because I think that's where to push for that, because I think it tends to, it seems like a too risky in my mind for the development officer to end up sort of resorting back to arm's length practices that I think long term are not going to sort of serve their own professional development. Like, I think we learn things at the lunch table that you can't learn in a classroom, for example, or in a breakout session at a conference. But to lend credibility to some of the pushback that I occasionally get on this idea that, Jason, sometimes people don't want to be at the lunch table. It's not sort of part of their cultural narrative. It's not who they are. What do you do instead? And what's your thoughts?
So you're saying if the donor or the prospect doesn't want to be at the lunch table, or the nonprofit.
Yeah, I've never. Yes, no. It's the donor. There's a subtle. And I've never heard anybody. And my listeners can take me to task on this. They're certainly welcome to take a spot on the next lineup. But sometimes there's sort of a subtle suggestion that, and I don't even know if I believe it. I don't know if I honestly believe it. But there's a subtle suggestion sometimes that some of our donors don't genuinely want to sit across the lunch table from us.
And they have good reasons for it.
And I don't know if I buy it.
Yeah, I would say most of the time that's BS. Prospects don't tell you the full truth all the time. And they're usually doing it because they don't want to hurt your feelings. So you'll hear things like, oh, I don't have the time. Now's not a good time. I just don't. They'll come up with all kinds of reasons, or I just don't have the money right now, so I don't want to waste your time.
They'll hide behind things. I call it hiding. They'll hide behind any number of things to just realize. In fact, they'll hide behind all sorts of the wrong reasons because they just really don't want to reveal to you what is the true reason.
Right. So here's the key. Overcome. You've got to be able to get to the true reason. Sometimes I do believe. Sometimes the true reason is I don't want to meet with you because I'm very set in my giving patterns. I already know who I give the most money to, or there's a variety of reasons that people seriously just like, I don't want to meet with you. And if you were to push it, you would harm the relationship. And so you've got to if it really is the case that they don't want to see you, but they still want to have a relationship. Sometimes I just ask them, like, look, some of the people I work with, they like to meet once a quarter or once a year. Other people, they just like to get a phone call from me once a year. And in one instance, for example, a guy giving us $10,000 a year, he's given several seven-figure gifts to different places. And he told me, like, look, I just don't care about your organization enough to make the time for it right now. And so I'm not gonna try to force him to do something he doesn't want to do because I want it to happen the way that I want. But I would say, generally speaking, if you're hearing that more than one time out of 50 somebody just doesn't do lunch, then you're getting lots of hiding answers, as you would say.
Yeah, or denial. I think that's the harm that gets done with arm's length fundraising, is that it conditions us to think that our large numbers of constituents, so if you've got for most organizations, it's thousands, if not tens of thousands of donors, that you sort of culturally condition yourself to believe that these people don't want to interact with you in meaningful ways. And I'm thinking, now I've worked for large, I worked for a large health charity in Washington. I've worked with very small organizations and everyone in between. And my consulting, my consulting portfolio is very broad as well. Yeah. And I just don't encounter that many charitable people who don't want to engage in meaningful ways. I totally get the fact that during COVID that they don't want to have lunch with you, or that, wearing a mask is not, whatever. I get that. But I just don't buy into the idea that they don't want to meet.
Yeah. It's extraordinarily rare. I mean, it would just be weird. Like, because if you're an organization that's a top priority and they don't want to meet with you, if that's what you think, it's because you're really not a very high priority to them, I would say 99 times out of 100.
Yeah. And Kevin, that's the hard thing for, I think, a lot of us to wrestle with, is that sometimes when we're getting turned down, The donor is signaling back to us really just the dark side of what it is we've been doing to them. We've been signaling to them for years. I was working with a client for quite some time, and they had a, you know, they had a 30-year history of being heavily invested in a very robust, it was an impressive direct response program, mixed with an event calendar, but they had no history in a 30-year history of engaging with donors in any one-on-one meaningful sort of way and moving these donors to more meaningful levels of support. And what was happening is that we finally enlisted a major gifts officer. We said, okay, you need to get on the phone. And what they kept running into is basically the you know, I've been giving to you for 30 years. Why are you calling me now? Sort of thing.
Right.
And the donor is basically, you know, that's not the donor who's saying we don't routinely sit down with somebody else that we care. That donor is saying, I routinely sit down with my niece and nephew or my neighbor or my buddy down the street and have coffee. But you've been sending you a check of $25 for 30 years and you've never talked to me once. So why would I do that? I think that's the harm of having sat in these shallow relationships for decades.
Yes. So a lot of times that leads to, sometimes we have to apologize. And if you call somebody and that's the question, you got to start out with an apology. It's like, you're right. We have screwed this up for two decades of relationship with you or lack thereof. And so I'm calling right now to attempt to fix that. And we're doing things differently now. And I think that's where it begins a lot of times is with an apology.
Yeah. And this organization wasn't there. And so... Just like starting a relationship on a thank you, I think you can start remarkable relationships on an apology.
Yes.
Because you open yourself up to that vulnerable place of sort of taking responsibility for what sort of got you here. And when we think of sort of a world that we sort of live in now, apologies are perhaps sort of a good place to sort of try to begin to clear the slate and start over.
Yeah, that's a good piece of advice in general. More apologies would make the world a better place, I think.
Kevin, I can tell you and I could keep each other going probably for another 45 minutes to an hour, but we lose our listeners at about this point. So if somebody's listening and they're like, I want to pick up this banter with Kevin and maybe get some advice from him or maybe push back on some of your ideas, how would you suggest that they do that?
Yeah, please push back. I love a good conversation that we can all learn something from. I don't have a website just yet, but One Visit Away is my podcast. The idea being you're just one visit away from a transformational experience for your benefactors and your organization. You can find that anywhere you listen to podcasts or just search Kevin Fitzpatrick on Apple Podcasts. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. I just posted today eight tips to increase the number of your visits over the phone. And those are the best places to find me right now.
All right, buddy. Hey, it was a pleasure. You're always welcome back. All you got to have is a big idea or bold opinion about the fundraising profession. Thanks.
Awesome. Thanks, Jason.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.